Recently, I came across a Salman Rushdie's essay from 1992, where he interprets in detail the legendary movie The Wizard of Oz. Interestingly, the essay disputes a famous notion that was the key part of the finale of the movie and became one of the most quoted sentences from it in the Western popular culture. There is no place like home. Rushdie argues that Dorothy embodies two fundamental human dreams that, at the same time, contradict each other. The dream of having roots on the one hand, and the dream of leaving on the other. According to Rushdie, the great tension between these two dreams is at the heart of The Wizard of Oz. The author concludes, "The truth is that once we leave our childhood places and start to make up our lives, armed only with what we know and who we are, we come to understand that the real secret of the ruby slippers is not that there is no place like home, but rather that there is no longer any such place as home, except, of course, for the homes we make or the homes that are made for us, which is anywhere and everywhere, except the place from which we began." Reading this made me think, what does home mean to us now, more than 80 years after the movie was released? In this hectic and confusing modern world, it often seems like one doesn't even need to experience natural disasters, wars, or other terrible misfortunes to feel displaced and lacking of identity. Where does this come from? And can literature help us pinpoint, verbalize, and deal with the sense of loss that ensues from the lack of roots, or the inability to leave, or both? This is Literature from Finland podcast, brought to you by Helsinki Literary Agency. My name is Urte. And in this episode, best-selling author Merja Mäki discusses the trauma of displacement and various notions of home. Welcome, Merja.
Thank you for inviting me. It's nice to see you and to participate in the discussion.
It's very, very nice to have you here on the season's last episode. Before the summer, I thought that home is a good topic to talk about. So as we start with the analogy of Wizard of Oz, I wanted to ask you whether you have seen the movie or maybe read the book, and if so, what do you make of it? What to you seems the moral of the story?
Yes, I'm familiar with the story. I have read the book and seen the movie as well as the stage adaptation performed in Seinäjoki City Theatre here in Finland. Mm. I find Rushdie's interpretation very touching. I remember that Dorothy didn't leave home voluntarily, and that determines the way she feels about leaving home. She constantly seeks her way back home, despite the fact that she is in the middle of adventure. She should feel excited instead of missing home all the time. But if she had chosen to leave home herself, maybe she would have considered her new environment as a place it is also called, a wonderland. Mm. And maybe she would have started to live a life of her own there. And yet, I imagine, what if Dorothy's homecoming would have been frightening, even dangerous? What if, for example, the storm had still been raging? Probably Dorothy would have longed for home even more in that situation. Mm. So if you leave your childhood place for your own free will, you understand that there is no more such place as home, like Rushdie arguments. But when one is forced to leave, homesickness remains strong.
Yeah,
that kind of emotional climate seems to be very familiar for evacuees and maybe for refugees also. And that has been my point of view while writing my novel Before the Birds.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. Your debut novel, Before the Birds, was published in spring 2022, immediately garnered widespread critical and commercial acclaim, loads of reviews from book bloggers, from just readers, and also critics, of course. The book follows a young woman called Ali, who, together with her family, is forced to leave her home in Karelia, a region in eastern Finland, a large part of which was ceded to the Soviet Union during World War II. Not only does a story about the strenuous evacuation, about the hardships of evacuation, but also about an unexpected life-changing responsibility, as well as coming to terms with the complicated relationship with Ali's own mother, and somehow also about continuing to dream. Our podcast is mainly listened to by our audiences abroad. Could you first elaborate a little bit on the historical context? What exactly do we refer to when we talk about the evacuees? And why is this an exceptional and perhaps particularly traumatic period for Finland? As I understand, the entire Finland was one way or another carrying the burden of the massive evacuation.
The fictional tale of Ali happens in February 1940. It's the third month of the Winter War, 3 months after the outbreak of the World War II. And like you said, the Soviet Union has invaded Finland without declaring war. They were militarily superior, and their war material, especially tanks and aircrafts, was enormous.
Mm.
The Soviets made several demands, including that Finland should cede substantial border territories as an exchange for land elsewhere, appealing mostly for security reasons, primarily the protection of Leningrad, which is 32 kilometers from the Finnish border.
Mm.
And the hostilities ceased in March 1940 with the signing of the Moscow Peace Treaty, in which Finland ceded 9% of its territory to the Soviet Union. There was no decent plan for evacuation, but about 430,000 Karelians were evacuated during the Winter War and right after that.
Yeah,
and that was about 11% of Finland's population at the time.
Which is enormous.
Enormous, yeah. The Karelians were given a few days to leave their homes, where they mostly had lived all their lives. When the order was given, the only instruction were to pack food for 5 days' need, enough warm clothes for the very frosty weather, some gas, important documents, personal property, only as much as one could carry by himself, and taking into account around 10 or 12 or even more kilometers march per day.
Yeah.
Of course, people needed to do all kind of preparations, like driving grain to the railway stations, slaughter the cattle 2 weeks to manage the march, and so on. And of course, all the working age men were still at the front line.
Yeah.
So preparations were made mainly by women, children, and elderly.
Mm.
When leaving, people didn't know where they were heading, how they would be transported, when they were coming back home, or were they coming back home at all. The trains and lorries were mainly reserved for the use of army, so many Karelians finally walked with their cattle.
Yeah.
Several experts speak about the multi-generational war trauma, which generation after generation buried, all the way to the fourth generation. And it wasn't traumatic only for those who had to leave, but also for those who had to share their dwellings and lands with the strangers.
Yeah.
I have grown in western parts of Finland, and I think there the war trauma manifests itself as being silent and not to talk about difficult emotions.
Yeah.
Previous generations may not have talked about the war, but they fear all the grief has been conveyed from the nonverbal expressions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and one of the most impressive parts, there are many impressive parts in your novel, one of the most impressive parts is exactly that kind of very practical part of evacuation. What does it mean when you have to, I don't know, take a cow together with you on this really long trip by foot to you don't even know where, and the cow starts giving birth and these kind of things. It's really, really, I don't think that we really think about that when we think about evacuees, like what kind of physical strain first of all it is, yeah. And then of course traumas, psychological traumas that you talk about. The publication of Before the Birds coincided with the war in Ukraine, but you started writing the book before that, long before that, of course. What inspired you to delve into this particular period of Finnish history?
I think the idea was born when I had my first child. According to an old Finnish saying, the child is only on loan from his parents, meaning that a child should grow as an independent adult, as a part of the surrounding society, and finally parents become unnecessary. And somehow it was very touching to first carry a child in my arms and then suddenly see him to take his first steps away from me towards the interesting world around us.
Yeah.
And of course, that's how it goes. But then I thought about the mothers and what it was like to them during the war. To give up with a son meant something way worse to these mothers. They had to escort their sons on a trip which led to front lines. And right then, when the sons had grown old enough to help the families to do all the hard work, for example, in fields and barns. And I thought of myths about heroes, about mothers, and realized that both soldiers and mothers are willing to sacrifice themselves because of someone more important than they are.
Yeah.
And I don't wish these hero stories to happen ever again in real life. But being a mother of a son, I felt that I have to do something to protect peace. And I guess writing stories about war is what I can do best.
Yeah,
and I don't write about war just to describe all the cruelties, but to preserve history, to remind that war is not gray. It's the deepest black. And I think that work for peace must be done particularly at peace time. And I started the process by doing background work. I studied history about 5 years before publishing the book. And part of that time I was also writing.
Yeah, yeah. Very impressive. And exactly what you say, it's very interesting about the blackness of war and writing not only about the heroes of war that are on the front, but the heroes who stay at home. And as you said in the beginning, that the burden of evacuation, for instance, fell on mothers, on women, on elderly people who were very old at the time, and on children at the same time. So we kind of, I think, often also forget that when the war happens, everyone is involved one way or another, and everyone suffers from it, every single person. Personally, to me, one of the most moving and thought-provoking themes developed in the novel is the sense of displacement, which also inspired the angle for this podcast. even though the Karelians have always been part of Finland, the main protagonist, Ali, doesn't feel at home in the Western Finland where she flees. The Karelians speak a different language. The customs and manners are different. They're not sometimes not even understood at all. So the Karelians, when they flee, they seem to come to sort of in between space. They are not Russians, but they're not like the rest of the Finns either. So coming back to the idea of Salman Rushdie, that one of the fundamental dreams of human beings is to have roots, how do you think this dream is fulfilled in Ali's case, in the main protagonist's case, or more generally in the case of displaced Karelians?
Yeah, I think the world was bigger back in 1940s. There were differences between Western and Eastern Finland when it comes, for example, to dialects, religion, food culture. And of course, knowledge wasn't offered in the ways than nowadays, not to speak about photographs or touring guides. And that's why prejudices and even polarization appeared both sides of Finland. But I emphasize that it was still about evacuees, not refugees. Karelians spoke their own dialect, but still Finnish. Some of them were Greek Catholic or Orthodox, as we say today. But for example, married to an evangelical Lutheran.
Yeah.
I think the main problem weren't the differences between Karelians and all the other Finns. Instead, it was the fact that very few Karelians were willing to leave their home behind. And also the majority of hosts felt bad to share their property with strangers, like we talked earlier. Usually Karelians didn't want to complain because they were given help anyway. But there are stories about Karelians' inappropriate treatment. So yes, like you said, one very important and also painful theme is the sense of displacement. Evacuee does not only seek a geographic but also social place where to be. And Ali, she feels outsider in many ways. But I think Ali's strength is to preserve hope in her life. And in the end of the novel, hope awakes.
And when I think about the history of displaced people, it kind of relates a little bit to what you said already, but throughout the centuries, it seems quite common that in a new place, they try to form their own communities with all their familial landmarks instead of completely blending in the culture of the new home. If you're forced to leave your roots behind, can you replicate them somewhere else? Why do you think people seek that?
Yeah, acculturation has different phases in which one's culture is seen as bad or good or a bit both, depending on the phase one is processing. Acculturation process has a certain outcome. Specialists often speak about four different stages of adaptation. The situation you describe is often defined as isolation or separation.
Yeah.
And the best alternative would be integration, where one has a positive attitude towards the new cultural environment one lives in. I guess you named the problem very well. When one is forced to leave home, the attitude towards new home easily remains negative. And in Western Finland, where I'm from, I have seen the separation you mentioned. Right after the war, Karelian evacuees were sometimes forbidden to use their own dialect or manners in school. I think it was hard to them to be different from the others, and evacuees quickly learned to hide their own cultural manners which also their children learned.
Yeah.
But I have noticed that today, quite often, when Karelian descendant marries a non-Karelian person, especially the non-Karelian spouse appreciates the Karelian roots and, mm-hmm. and likes to maintain the roots. Mm. She or he hasn't learned to remain silent, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that in the modern day, we perhaps lack more clearly defined communities in our societies that would help us strengthen the sense of belonging?
No, when I look at the pictures taken during our latest wars in Finland, I always pay attention on one thing. In the 1940s, everything was done together. The structure of society insisted that the most important occupation, as we know, was agriculture or fishing, and no man could have done that job by himself.
Yeah.
On the other hand, working life today aims to increase productivity, which often means less workforce for every task. But during the war, community interest meant more than individuals. Now we appreciate individuality above all. Almost anything is possible, as we know, for example, country of residence. Society takes care of the elderly people, so your own children don't necessarily have to. Young people don't automatically have to choose their parents' profession, and so on and so on. And freedom and equal opportunities are good, of course. But sometimes I think, is there a point when young person simply has too many choices, so he cannot make decisions anymore at all?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Your question is good and also hard to answer.
Yeah. Yeah. And how much do we actually miss that community? And I think during the pandemic, I saw this very interesting change in Finland at the time, where I started seeing my neighbors in the backyard all of a sudden kind of taking care of each other's children. Mm-hmm. And you could see that these are the people who I've seen them before, and they maybe would say hello, but they would never kind of interact with each other more than that. And all of a sudden during the pandemic, this great and very strange circumstance kind of forced them and made them be a community. And all of a sudden, you know, the neighbors were like really helping each other, and there were all these groups where people would bring food to maybe elderly people. So I think I ask this question because, thinking of this episode, I think I realized that quite often we miss community more than we maybe realize.
Yeah, and when the circumstances are very unusual, it awakens something which is very deep in humanity.
Yes.
Like, for example, helping elderly in neighborhood.
Absolutely, absolutely, I agree. I think the number of Finnish fiction books that one way or another deal with the war or with war are truly really staggering, even to this day. Why do you think this is the case? Is it because of the particularly complex history that Finland has? Or maybe Finns are actually better at discussing the painful historical moments and reconciling with them?
Right after our latest wars, literature had a mission. The same mission as all the surrounding society had.
Mm.
Everyone was focusing on healing broken people, fix broken buildings. Hero stories were told. Propaganda was still used. And all this was necessary. There was no time or space to grieve or process the trauma.
Yeah.
But I represent the fourth generation calculated from the wars. People of my generation have rarely lived the same household with frontline veteran or Lotta.
Yeah.
We haven't heard authentic war stories.
Mm.
We were the grandchildren. We weren't told to, of course. But thanks to that, modern authors have enough distance to war. It has come time to process marginal destinies, minority stories, the most painful concealed stories, and art has enormous power to do that. It is also said that even too much has been written about war. But like I said earlier, a memory of war fades if we don't keep talking about it. Civilizations develop, but still new wars begin all the time. And I think there is plenty more space for new war novels still.
Do you think that your novel might have helped some people to open up about their personal experience of displacement?
I have thought about that a lot. After publishing Before the Birds a year and a half ago, I have visited several events and being interviewed, and I have noticed that quite often someone in the audience cries during my performance or right after it. And I think that means two things. First of all, we Finns haven't processed our multi-generational war trauma enough. And second, the war in Ukraine has reactivated our nation's own memories of our war.
Mm.
And I suppose that tears seen in events are purifying. When we gather to discuss Alli's Eva Key story, we can safely, from a distance, face difficult experiences and difficult feelings. And that is what art is all about. The function of art is to make a private experience universal. Alli's story awakens thoughts of the history and reader's own family. I hope it offers support to the reader, the feeling that one is not alone. And when my novel's translation rights were first sold to Ukraine, I really wished the book to be a relatable tale. Of course, it is too early, but when it comes time for Ukraine to process their national war trauma, I hope readers notice that leaving home happened to someone else as well, and they survived.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very moving moment, I think, that so your novel is now has been sold to three territories altogether, Ukraine, Sweden, and France. And Ukraine was the first one to acquire the novel, and it was just sharing a little personal moment because it was in the autumn when I, being an agent and also being an agent of your book, went to Gothenburg Book Fair, and it was last autumn, and it was a very depressing book fair because everybody, all the publishers were very down about the prices and all the difficulties that the publishing industry is experiencing at the moment. And in Gothenburg Book Fair, you mostly meet publishers from northern countries, from Norway, from Sweden, from Denmark, some Germans. And constantly meeting after meeting, I was hearing the same story that we don't have money to publish the books and we really have to be very selective and it's so difficult now, and everybody were complaining. And I really came back after Gothenburg like, oh my God, this is really terrible moment for publishing. And then weeks after that, the first publisher who acquires your novel is Ukrainian publisher who is in the middle of the war, who, like, I hear this story still every day. There are translators who translate book in, like, hiding from, you know, in shelters from bombing, and they still do their job. And we get from publisher in Ukraine who has acquired another book of ours, of our agency on our list, a couple of years ago, and in the middle of a war, we would receive a message from him like, I'm really sorry, I'm a bit late with my royalty statement, but it's coming. It's incredible to me, the kind of the strength and the perspective that we, I think wars, as tragic as they are, they do provide a certain perspective, and we do realize how good of a life we have and what's at stake. I think it was just I just wanted to share because I thought that it was a very moving moment that made kind of, I think, all of us just stop a little bit and think like, yeah, we don't have a reason to complain.
Oh, thank you for sharing the story.
Yeah,
really moving, like you said.
I mentioned that the publication of your novel coincided with the beginning of a full-scale war in Ukraine. Would you say that in that context, your novel somehow changed for you personally?
It was quite confusing that after 5 years of watching all kind of documents about war, the same imagery suddenly was all around media. I thought civilization is evolving, but wars still happen again and again.
Yeah, right near to us. What is home to you, Merja-Mäki?
I am a grandchild of an evacuee myself, and I guess my heritage is that I don't get attached to certain buildings or certain cities. My home is in close people, especially people I love.
Yeah. To finish, as usually, three very literary questions. Who is your current literary crush?
Current is Anni-Kuu Nupponen and her novel Sydänmeri, which was just published by Kummerus, and tells a magical story of a lady who guards the seas.
Wow, I haven't heard of this yet, I have to read it.
It's lovely.
What was the most surprising book you've recently read?
Maybe works of a Finnish children's author Timo Parvela. He has written a fantasy series called Varjot, which leads a reader to a dark and a bit scary world of Santa Claus. And he has great cliffhangers in his books.
Wow. Which author or book never fails to make you laugh?
Being interviewed, maybe Juha Hurme.
Okay. he's quite a legend.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Merja-Mäki, for the interview. It was lovely, lovely, lovely to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for invitation.
Thank you, Merja-Mäki. This was Literature from Finland, brought to you by Helsinki Literary Agency and hosted by me, Urte. Special thanks to Petri Latvala for the design and Alessandra Dana for the music, and to all the colleagues at the agency. We are taking the summer break now, but we'll be back in autumn, so don't forget to tune in next episode.